Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today, we're keeping it all in the family. We are here with one of CNAS's own, Ilan Goldenberg. Ilan is a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program here at CNAS. He is a foreign policy and defense expert with extensive government experience covering Iran's nuclear program, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and broader challenges in the Middle East. And today we are here to talk about one of the thorns in the side of the transatlantic partnership, and that is Iran. So Ilan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
You have been doing quite a lot of work on Iran, and I know that you just got back from talking about Iran and Europe. So we will turn to the European piece of this in a second, but I thought maybe just to kind of level set the conversation, it would be great to hear your views on where U.S. policy is on Iran. Obviously, things have heated up quite dramatically. So what's going on? Where are we?
Sure. So basically, you know, maybe we'll pull it back about a year to May of 2018, when Donald Trump decides finally, after a year of hemming and hawing, to leave the Iran nuclear deal. Now, Iran, in response to that, does something pretty unusual. It shows tremendous restraint. What the Iranians decide their strategy is going to be is to try to pull the U.S. away from the other members of the P5 plus one. That would be, you know, the Europe, the E3, Russia, and China. And what the Iranians do is they pursue a strategy of staying in the nuclear deal while basically asking the other parties to the deal to make them whole, to, you know, give them economic benefits, to engage with them politically. Now, they partially succeed. The Iranians succeed in really isolating the United States from the other members of the P5. However, the problem is they can't really get any of the economic benefits that they want. And the problem is that you have all these European governments who would be very happy to see some economic engagement with Iran, to sort of see Iran get the economic benefits it gets for staying and for restraining its nuclear program. None of the international corporations are interested in doing that. Nobody wants to risk their economic, their access to the American banking system. And so over time, basically, the Iranians grow increasingly frustrated. And then we have this key moment in late April, early May, where the United States decides, okay, we're now going to go and try to get oil sales out of Iran down to basically zero barrels per day, or as low as possible. During, you know, when Iran's selling at full capacity, it's selling at about 2.5 million barrels per day. When we had sanctions in 2012 and 13 in the Obama administration, we got down to 1 million. And again, we were down at 1 million as of May of this year. And what we were doing was putting as much pressure as we could on other countries, but also giving a little bit of space for countries like China, India, Turkey to buy some oil. And we decided in May we're going to go to zero. And for the Iranians, that was the last straw. And this internal debate that had been going on, should we stay restrained or should we start pushing back, shifted. And then you start to see, you know, attacks on a number of tankers in the UAE in early May. Then maybe the most brazen attack is mid-June, where Iran attacks two tankers in the Gulf of Oman and does it, including a Japanese flag tanker, while, you know, Japanese Prime Minister Abe is there. For the first time in 40 years, you had a Japanese Prime Minister in Tehran, and there's the Iranian government, you know, blowing up a Japanese tanker. I mean, it was shocking to me, really kind of pretty stunning. And then we almost, of course, we have the drone a few days later, where the U.S. almost ends up in a military confrontation with Iran after Iran shoots down a drone. And so what the Iranians are trying to do with all of this is basically send messages. The message to the United States is, enough, we're only gonna take so much, and we're gonna start, there's gonna be costs. You can't just exert maximum pressure on us and try to squeeze our economy and not expect costs. The message to the Gulf states, especially to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who have been very supportive of this approach, is, you're not gonna let us sell our oil, we're not gonna let you sell your oil. And the message to Europe, and to the Japanese and to pretty much all these countries who are in the middle of trying to navigate between the U.S. And Iran is, you can't keep telling us politically that you're gonna, that we want us to stay in the JCPOA and do all these things for us, but not do anything, not deliver anything economic for us, even if it's outside of these governments' control. I don't think the Iranians view it that way. So the message to them is, enough, there's a cost to you too. And so that's kind of where we are. I think the good news is, I don't think the Iranians actually want a war. They just want a signal. I mean, even these attacks in the Gulf, one thing about them is the mines have always been put above the water lines of these ships, and that is very critical, because if the mines were put below the water lines of these ships, you'd have major oil spills, potentially tankers sinking, higher likelihood of loss of life. Purposely didn't do that. You know, there's a reason that that where the mines are going. And as we saw from President Trump, I don't think the U.S. really wants a conflict either, right? I mean, he's willing to talk tough, but, you know, when the moment came, he pulled back, and I think that's ultimately where he is too. So the good news is nobody really wants a conflict, and the bad news is a conflict can still happen, right? You can still have this either miscalculation, the Iranians go too far, there's some kind of an accident. You know, if you remember 2016, we had an American ship that wandered into Iranian territorial waters. We had channels then. We had, you know, Javad Zarif and John Kerry talking to each other on the phone right after the ship was being detained by the Iranians, and within hours it was released. In this environment, you know, that could lead to a major conflict. So, you know, if you were to ask me where are things going, I'd say not good. But it might just sort of stay at this level, or maybe it explodes, or maybe there's an opportunity for diplomacy also.
You know, you mentioned the two patrol craft that strayed into Iranian waters. What's interesting to add to that is that you're right about the channels, and in fact they were already meeting, as you know, and so this became very easily a part of the U.S.-Iranian discussion, and very quickly resolved itself. But at the time, Trump was tweeting about that too, as a private citizen, and saying what a shame it was, what an insult to the United States. We should never let something like this happen to us again. Certainly laying out the image that he was someone who would have taken military action to save the honor of the United States. Now he's in a place where he could do that. So you're right about the not having the channels, but we also have a president who, at least from those tweets at that time, seems more likely to take military action in a situation like that, where U.S. Assets have actually been taken.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. He also, I mean, so there's the positive and the negative, right? The other positive is he campaigned very much on the idea of getting us out of wars in the Middle East. And so does he really want to go back in there? Now, on the other hand, and the other thing I'll say is actually even his decision to not strike, you know, despite some hand-wringing in Washington about American credibility, I was actually in the Middle East at the time. I was in the Gulf, in the UAE. I think they were very relieved that he did not strike. And the Gulf states have been pretty careful, you know, despite the perception. They all love the maximum pressure strategy. They want to squeeze Iran and try and break it as much as possible. But whoa, starts leading to conflict, and they're like, wait a minute, you know, I'm not sure I really want this. And do I really trust Donald Trump? Is he really reliable enough in a scenario?
Yeah, that's the big trust bit, not only in the Gulf but among allies too. Do we want to follow Donald Trump in terms of just escorting ships through and being on board if things were to escalate, and being part of something bigger that they didn't sign up to do?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's I think one of the biggest dangers. But you are right. If you know, there is this risk that. If you really insult his pride, or if the Iranians misunderstand and go too far, I mean, we don't have a good record of understanding their red lines, and they don't have a good record of understanding our red lines. And so in that scenario, the possibility that they push too far, they do something. I mean, the drone was a perfect example of that. I don't think they expected a near American conventional response on their territory, but that's what almost happened. And I think they kind of, you know, scared them a little bit. But they don't really understand that. We don't really understand where they're at exactly. And so this is where channels are critical. And actually, it's also an important place where Europe can potentially be valuable, at least is trying to sort of play this diplomatic role. I mean, the other voice of optimism is, you know, Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, was actually in New York last week.
Right.
And he put some public offers on the table that are kind of... I mean, really, it's a non-starter. Like his offer was, you know, maybe we'll speed up certain elements of things we'll agree to to do, like, I think permanently ratifying the additional protocol, which is just to basically continue to do what we're doing in the nuclear deal, but speed up some of the future commitments in exchange for sanctions relief. I don't think that's a starter with the Trump administration, but it was interesting. He met with Rand Paul also. And so there is, I don't think the Trump administration and the Iranians are at a place where they could come to some kind of big deal on a whole bunch of things. I don't think it's possible. I'm not even sure this administration has the capacity or knows what it wants at that technical level. But I do see a scenario where somehow Iran reaches out, probably around Bolton and Pompeo, directly to the president, just like they did on North Korea. And it could be a European partner who does that. It needs to be somebody who the president really trusts. It could be a member of Congress and says, and you get some kind of a sort of stand down on both sides, like some pullback on sanctions for, you know, Iran going fully back into the nuclear deal that it's now starting to violate on the edges, and everybody calms down. And then they start negotiating, and that goes nowhere. But that would still be better than where we are right now.
I wanted to talk to you specifically about the British tanker. So we talk about this. Obviously, there's an environment. Tensions are extremely high. And one piece of this picture is the Iranian seizure of the British tanker. Can you give us a little overview of what happened there? And I think I myself, not following this closely, have so many questions about, you know, why would Iran be willing to go after the Brits who, I mean, it's the Europeans, it's the UK, the French, and et cetera, who have sought to dilute sanctions, to mitigate the effect of sanctions on Iran. I mean, they're kind of in Iran's corner, so to speak. And so why would the Iranians be willing to go after a British tanker? And I mean, from my perspective, it's almost like biting the hand that feeds you. What was their goal or their motive there?
Sure.
There's a little tit for tat, but so that's a piece of it. Yeah. But
sure, no. And actually, so I do think it's important to distinguish between some of the Europeans also. I mean, Britain has this sort of colonial history there. 1953 and the coup, which is a key moment, you know, for Iran. It was really the U.S. and Great Britain that supported that and helped engineer the overthrow of what would have been a potentially democratic government in Iran and reinstall the Shah. And so out of everybody, I mean, the Brits also, when things were bad between the U.S. and Iran in 2011 and 2012, don't forget the British embassy was basically overrun. So the Brits, out of all the Europeans, are the biggest target for the Iranians based on history. So important to remember that context. Now, what happened? The Brits took a Iranian oil tanker going through the strait, you know, around Gibraltar, that had gone into British territorial waters.
But that it was also taking oil to Syria, right?
Yes.
In contravention of sanctions.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That's why they stopped the ship. Now, this has been going on for years. It's kind of weird that, like, at this moment, just as things are getting super tense in the Gulf, you know, in the Persian Gulf, that's when the Brits seize this ship. And I can't understand exactly what happened there and what they were thinking. And like you said, I was just in London, I don't think anybody fully 100% understood it there either.
What was particularly interesting, too, is that coming at a time not just of tensions, you know, with the Iranians and this type of thing, but coming at a time of tensions between the EU and the UK as well. You had Prime Minister May on her way out. Boris Johnson, of course, wasn't crowned then. But that's the first thing that struck me when I heard about that was, why all of a sudden, on behalf of the EU, is the UK swinging in and stopping this tanker? I just was wondering what the backstory was to that, just in terms of the EU-UK relationship.
Yeah, and it's exactly. So it's not 100% clear what happened. I think it was a combination probably. Well, here, first of all, what it wasn't. There's all these conspiracy theories out there that the U.S. somehow tricked the UK into doing that. I mean, the U.K. has said no to the U.S. on one Iran initiative after another for the past year. And suddenly they're like, yeah, sure, let's do this because the Americans said so. Like, don't buy that. You know, and that was something I heard in London from some people, and just nobody's serious, nobody who really understands the way, you know, British decision making is actually made. So I think it was the American military did ask for it. So, you know, the British military likes to say yes to the American military. You did have, I think certainly the people working in Syria were like, great, we're so frustrated, anything we can do to stop that. I think the UK is in the middle of a leadership competition and And so I wouldn't be surprised if the foreign minister was at least distracted. I don't think it would be something you'd do on purpose, but there was just all this stuff going on and nobody really thought through. The one feeling that seemed uniform across London is like, nobody really thought through how Iran would respond here. And Iran responded in a way that pretty much any Iran expert, anybody who's watched Iranian behavior for a long time would tell you, tit for tat. You take one of our ships, take one of yours. They didn't just take the ship. They took the ship almost, they released video of how they took the ship. They took the ship almost exactly the same way the Brits took the ship.
Yeah.
And they did that on purpose. The problem is now, UK is totally stuck, if you ask me. I mean, I think these two ships are going to sit in port for months, years, who knows. You'll probably trade the crews eventually, but because the UK doesn't want to be tagged with the maximum pressure strategy and fear of, you know, Bolton and Pompeo dragging them into a war. But they need to somehow assert themselves. And that's where you get this kind of, you know, we're going to do a European flotilla. I mean, I don't know what you guys think. Do they have the capacity to sustain that for a while?
I love the UK and the Royal Navy and all the traditions that come with that. And they're the best sailors. I mean, I think a match between the Royal Navy and the U.S. Navy would be very interesting to watch and see what would happen. But over the last 10 to 15 years, the UK has cut back in a lot of areas, and one of those was surface vessels. And we've all been worried about the number of surface vessels that the Royal Navy had cutting into the mass that you need to have a sustained operation or a global presence. So right now, the Brits are caught between having a global presence, wanting to have that global presence, particularly with Brexit. They want to show that they are still global players, and Boris Johnson comes from this nostalgic tradition of the Royal Navy and Britannica ruling the waves. So they want to be able to do that. On the other hand, if they're going to have a sustained convoy going on in the Gulf, they've got to have surface vessels. Right now they have one. I heard they're going to send a couple more, but they need to do it with other Europeans and the United States. It's something that we have done forever. These maritime operations, we go according to NATO rules and regulations, we share intelligence. It's something we can do very fast, and we know how to do it. And I just am shocked that the UK, in fact, pivoted to Europe the way they did. There's a great backstory there. I mean, we can talk about why we think they did it. Is it out of pique, you know, with Trump? Is it because they don't want to be tagged with this, where Trump is on the JCPOA? There's a lot of reasons for it, but I can tell you, militarily, it's a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, my own theory, at least, is it's JCPOA. That's part of it, but more than that, it's deeper than just JCPOA. It's fear of if we're with the Americans and something blows up.
Right.
I mean, my understanding is,
right,
you know, at least what I heard when I was in London is, you know, when we were making, when Trump and the administration were making decisions about how to respond to the drone, I mean, UK had assets deployed and had no idea what was happening. So imagine now you're the UK and you're part of an operation that's purportedly being at least launched to defend your assets, and something bad happens and Donald Trump is sitting in the White House trying to figure it out. Nobody's telling you what's happening, and the American decision is we're going to strike X, Y, or Z, and now there you are. I mean, and especially after the experiences in Iraq. I mean, I can see that
that's
being—
That's exactly right.
That more than anything, I think that's got to be terrifying for the Brits.
Yeah.
So I know you've been a part of some of these Track 2 discussions with the Europeans and the Iranians in Europe. What's your sense from these conversations that you've had about what the Europeans are thinking about how to move forward? I mean, so clearly, with the U.S. out of JCPOA, what is the goal? What are the Europeans playing for? What are they going to try to accomplish? How do they move forward over the next year or two?
Yeah, well, so, you know, it's interesting. Whenever you go into a room with Europeans and Iranians, and I have done that a few times in the last couple of years, first of all, poor, and Americans, right? The poor Europeans, they're stuck in the middle where they're getting it from us, and we want them to just come to our side. And the Iranians, who are saying they're not doing enough, and we'll say they're not doing enough no matter what, you know, to give them what they want. And so Europe's been dealt a really tough hand in this situation. And ultimately, I mean, the problem is the government, we can talk about long-term, is the European Union going to look for ways, and Europe overall, going to look for ways to decouple a little bit from the American financial system so that they have more flexibility in their policy and don't get sucked into this. The reality is they have no power to compel their companies to do business in Iran, and we've forced that out. So they're stuck in the middle, and I actually think they've done a really good job, great job of diplomacy in the last 2 years, and they've done the only thing they can do, which is buy time and limit the damage. So, you know, Donald Trump came in saying I'm gonna walk away from the nuclear deal on January, you know, of 2017. And it took a year and a half almost for him to walk away. And a lot of that had to do, if you remember, there was a whole long negotiation process with Europe about how we work together in the E3 to try to stay in the deal. And eventually it failed, but it failed because the president was never gonna go for it, actually. The negotiations, from my understanding, were pretty constructive. But the president just ultimately wouldn't go for it. But through that process, the Europeans bought a year. Now they've been in all these negotiations with the Iranians to try and keep them in the deal, to try and do things like INSTEX, right, which is this supposed to be this channel they've been trying to set up to at least have transactions on non-sanctionable activities with Iran.
Do you have a sense of where that is?
I mean, it's very technical and very complicated. Eventually, you'll have some limited number of transactions that potentially go through. The biggest challenge actually is the Europeans have everything set up on their end, but you need to have an Iranian equivalent on their side, and that's harder and easier for the U.S. to sanction. So it'll never be more than a symbol. It'll never make a meaningful difference economically. And ultimately, I actually think it's up to China more than anyone to buy Iranian oil and try to keep the Iranians economically in the deal. What Europe can do is politics. But, you know, I think that the Europeans have done a really good job of just stringing this out as long as possible. And now it's all starting to collapse. And it will collapse. But it's going to collapse slowly. And so there's time. And, you know, they just need to be stretching this out as much as possible. And eventually, in my opinion, we'll have U.S.-Iran negotiations again, either when you have a new president in 2021 or the Iranians decide they had no choice but to deal with Trump. And that might happen even before 2021. If Trump is reelected, they will certainly deal with him, in my opinion. They're not gonna sit around and just continue to be sanctioned this way for the next 4 or 5 years when they have other options.
We're running short of time, and I have one last question statement to go back to, and then over to Andrea to close us down. You know, I think if you take it to a next higher level, this crisis as an example of how we work with allies now in this new era, this is a bit of a test of that. And one thing that has become pretty clear now is there was a time, particularly with the Brits, where in order to handle cutting back on your force structure, you cut back, but you also then integrated your force structure in with other allies so that, frankly, you couldn't do things without being a part of a larger allied force. And the Brits particularly did that, and they've created lots of multinational forces like the Joint Expeditionary Force, the JEF, and other things too. I think the black swan in all of this, the totally unexpected occurrence to now cast doubt on this as a strategy, is the Brits always felt that they would be with the United States, that the Brits would not take on a military operation if the U.S. wasn't part of it or other allies. And I think what we're seeing now, this black swan event, is that they have now found, because of this new era we're in, that in fact they can be alone. And so they're going to have to deal with that because they have arranged a force structure much smaller, and they're going to have to build that out to be able to take something autonomous if they will not be with the U.S. or with a broader alliance. And we're seeing the sign of that right now.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It sort of says to me as the Iran guy, and you guys are the you know, really the Europe experts, that, you know, beyond this tanker incident and this decision to do the convoy without the United States and would have just been unthinkable a couple of years ago, and could have much more, like you're saying, profound, broader implications for U.S.-European defense cooperation writ large. This is really, like you said, a test case.
That's exactly right.
I think this is an excellent place to end. Interesting thoughts here at the end. Ilan, thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully As this continues to unravel, we'll be able to have you back. It's so helpful to hear the Iranian perspective on this and make sense of it. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me.